Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In his Washington Post review of Lee Billings' book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude, the astronomer Mike Brown compressed the age of the Earth into a human lifetime. In just the past 2 weeks, he wrote, primates came down from the trees and learned to navigate among the planets. In the past few minutes, they figured out that the stars in the sky are suns like our own. 10 seconds ago, they realized that those suns have planets around them. And within the next minute, it seems likely that they will discover the first evidence of life on those planets in the sky. We are in that minute, according to the fast-growing field of exoplanets, the search for planets outside of our solar system, with the idea that discovering one just like ours is a real possibility. Science journalist Lee Billings writes about the fate of our planet and the scientist on the leading edge of identifying whether there are so-called Goldilocks planets, not too big, not too small, not too hot, not too cold, that can sustain life just like ours out there in the cosmos. Lee is on the line with us to talk about his book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude. Thank you for being here.
Virginia, it's great to be here.
Lee, I wonder if you could start off by reading just the first paragraph of your book, which kicks off this wonderful narrative of the evolution of the known universe. Now, this is some 4.6 billion years ago. Let's begin, please, with the very birth.
This story properly begins 4.6 billion years ago, with the birth of our solar system from a cloud of cold hydrogen and dust, several light years wide. The cloud was but a wisp from a much larger mass of primordial gas, a stellar nursery manufacturing massive stars destined to explode as supernovae. One by one, the giant stars popped off like firecrackers, ejecting heavy elements that sizzled with radioactivity as they rode shockwaves through the murk like so much scattered confetti. One of those enriching shockwaves may have compressed the cloud, our cloud, in its passage. The cloud became dense enough for gravity to seize control, and it collapsed in on itself. Most of its material fell to its center to form a hot, simmering protostar. Eventually, the protostar gained enough mass to kindle a thermonuclear fire at its core, and the sun began to shine. What was left of the cloud settled around the newborn star in a turbulent, spinning disk of incandescent vapor.
Lee Billings reading from the opening of his book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude. And thank you for that, Lee. I actually understood it while I was reading it. Where are we now in this evolution?
Well, we're kind of at the brink of amazing discoveries, potentially. The reason why I wrote the book right now was because we've been finding hundreds and actually now thousands of planets beyond the solar system, so-called exoplanets. And there's no real sign that the numbers of discoveries are going to slacken anytime soon. So you could soon be envisioning a world in which we know of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands even, of other solar systems, other planetary systems. And what that really means is that for the first time in the history of the biosphere, and perhaps the history of the universe, we're on the cusp of really discovering, in some sense, whether or not we're special and whether or not we're alone, and all these kind of deep, timeless existential questions, we have a chance of answering them. And that was really, I think that's where we are now, and that's why I wrote the book.
I'm reading about more than 900 exoplanets have been identified in the past 20 years, another 1,000 suspected, new candidates appearing almost every week. Tell us how this field is pursued. How do we know where to go and look?
Well, we know now, based on some of those statistics you mentioned, that the sheer number of planets we've found through the relatively short time we've been looking, that we can look anywhere. We can look at essentially any star in the sky, and if we look hard enough, chances are we'll find some planets around it. The way that we find planets is through mostly indirect methods. We're mostly looking at the stars themselves because the planets are so faint and dim. We can't really see them directly most of the time. So instead, we're just looking for fluctuations of starlight, wobbling stars or stars that slightly dim every now and then from a planet passing across their face and casting a shadow towards Earth. And these indirect effects are how we have detected most of the vast majority of planets that we now know beyond the solar system.
So we know, or can at least predict, that at some point our planet will cease to exist. So for very practical reasons, our successors will need a home. In that way, the search for life in the distant reaches of the universe is no less than making sure that life itself continues. Is that, in general, how the scientists that you spoke with consider the search for life on other planets?
Well, maybe in their quiet nighttime moments, I think so. I wouldn't say that all of them see that as the forefront or the primary reason, perhaps, for why they do what they do. But it was definitely, again, a core thing for me when I was trying to write the book, just this notion that, you know, we don't really know right now where we kind of stand in the big scheme of things. And it could be, it's entirely plausible that we may be essentially alone in the Milky Way in terms of complex life, whatever you want to call it, intelligence, civilization, these sorts of things. And if that's the case, it kind of goes against centuries of thought in the physical sciences, which have said that we're average, we're ordinary, we don't matter, and everything out there is going to be just like it is here. And if that is the case, and we are practically alone, maybe in the galaxy or our region of the galaxy, if not the observable universe, then it seems that we have some kind of responsibility, I think, to try to preserve this little spark of life and light that we have here and extend it as we can. And that's obviously going to be important in the far future. But the point is, we do have actually some sense of an expiration date for life on Earth, if for no other reason than that the sun will someday cease to shine.
We're guessing 5 billion years from now?
5 billion years from now, the sun is supposed to swell up into what's called a red giant, and it will engulf most of the inner planets and melt them down to slag. And long before that, though, life on Earth will have probably wound down and essentially ended. And that could actually come as soon as 500 million years from now, which may sound like a long time, but in the lifespan of the Earth, that's basically like telling a 45-year-old woman that she has 5 years left to live. So our planet and the possibilities for complex life upon it are actually kind of already middle-aged and even elderly, perhaps. So we really don't have a lot of time left.
Not a great story. But you introduce us to several scientists who are working on finding life in other places, including Frank Drake. He's now professor emeritus at UC Santa Cruz. He was at a SETI conference back in 1961 when he came up with what is known as the Drake equation. Now, how did Frank Drake pursue that search?
Well, essentially, Frank Drake is best known as the founder of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. In mid-century, 20th century, he pointed a radio telescope at two sun-like stars, Tau Ceti and Epsilon Eridani, and listened for radio signals coming from them, basically thinking that perhaps in the same way that we pump radio signals and TV signals and things like that out into the cosmos, maybe some other people around other nearby stars were doing that. And Frank Drake started laying down these various variables that would pin down the chances of this search being successful. And so that incorporates things like how often stars are formed, how often planetary systems are formed around those new stars, how many habitable planets may exist in any given planetary system, how often life occurs and arises on those planets, how often that life progresses to intelligence and then to technology and something that can build radio telescopes or rockets and things like that. So you string all these variables together, and in theory, you get this number at the end, and that number should be the number of civilizations that may exist right now in our Milky Way that we could detect. And what he found was that the most important variable was not, in fact, the number of planets or the number of stars or how often life even got started. The most important numbers seem to be how long a civilization, a technological civilization like ours, actually exists, how long it survives. And that number, that variable in the equation is called L. So in some sense, the search for other life is really a search for our own future. We're trying to figure out how long we can persist, where we're going to go in the future. And we're looking out there into space and the depths of it, and we're trying to see things that are perhaps more advanced than us and where we might go someday.
Well, despite the importance of that search or that quest, when you visited Frank at SETI Institute, it looked as if it were in hibernation, you write. You know, there are weeds growing around these radio telescopes. And much of this story of the passion and mechanics of the search for exoplanets is also about the failures that go along the way, many for lack of funding and lack of political will. Can you locate that shift when funding or the pursuit of that discontinued, at least on a federal level, and who's picking it up?
Well, it's really been a slow slide. It's been a process of gradual decay. So, for instance, NASA and the federal government of the United States hasn't actually funded any SETI searches since 1992. So you could say that that's one cutoff point. But more recently, with the advent of what I like to call the exoplanet boom, there were several telescopes that were planned by NASA and several other space agencies, and they ended up being canceled for lack of funding. So the point is that there's no singular date you can pinpoint, but there's been a lot of, I guess, setbacks. And in terms of who's picking it up or where it's being picked up, that's a really good question. I'm not quite sure what the answer is. These are very, very difficult tasks. It's a very difficult thing to whether you're trying to go out and find another civilization out there, or whether you're trying to just look for simple life on a planet very, very far away. It's not easy to do, and it's very expensive.
We're speaking with Lee Billings, science journalist. His work has appeared in Nature, New Scientist, and Scientific American, among other places. We're talking about his book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude. It is about the exoplanet boom and the search for life in any form on other planets far, far, far outside of our solar system. Lee, some of the other challenges are not in funding, but you alluded to it earlier about timing or perspective. You point out that if we were observing Earth from somewhere among the million stars of the Andromeda, we would see the Earth of 2.5 billion years ago. So at that point, forerunners of the Homo sapiens were producing stone tools, and go on from there, how the birth and evolution of our planet would look differently depending on where you sit in the universe. Can you go through that for us? It's so fascinating.
Well, sure. Yeah. So our galaxy is about 100,000 light years wide or so. So that means that on the other side of the galaxy, there's light right now from our planet, from our star, from our solar system that is trickling through the other side of the galaxy right now, and that light is about 100,000 years old. So if you think about what was happening on the planet 100,000 years ago, I guess you could talk to a geologist or a paleontologist, but I don't think there was a lot in terms of radio conversations or high technology. So what's important to think about is that in some ways, people or things out there very far away could know that we're here in some sense. But when I say we, I don't necessarily mean Virginia Prescott and Lee Billings. It would be more along the lines of knowing that the Earth was alive.
But that leads to the questions that planetary scientist Jim Castings discusses with you, that if we are searching for among exoplanets for signs of life, would we recognize it if we found it? You know, we might be looking at the analog planet 3 billion years ago. Would we say, oh, that's gonna turn into something?
Right, and that's a very good point. And this is something that researchers struggle with a lot, because usually in science, you don't want to base all of your extrapolations and all of your experiments off of a sample size of one. You don't want to just have one instance that you're drawing everything from. We really want to find a lot of other living planets, a lot of other habitable planets. And then if we did that, we would have a better idea of what the constraints actually are for life and what life in all its diversity can actually look like and how it manifests on planets. And we don't have a really good idea of that yet. So in some sense, you can look at the Earth's history, as Jim Casting has, and you can see that, let's look 3 billion years ago. 3 billion years ago, the Earth had a pretty thriving biosphere. Things were relatively alien here. You and I wouldn't want to go back there and try to live there. We'd suffocate because there's no oxygen in the atmosphere, or there's very little of it. But at the same time, there was a thriving biosphere from microbes, single-celled organisms that could do things like metabolize all kinds of things like sulfur or hydrogen and use sunlight to split that stuff. And they, some of them would produce methane. And there was a bunch of methane in the atmosphere. So you could think, well, maybe methane is a biosignature from back then. But it's very tricky. And the point, I think, really is that we have to start from what we know. We're unfortunately blinkered in our view, but that's just the best we have. We have to base our search on what life seems to be like here, because we know it pretty well, we understand it pretty well, and consequently, when we're looking for life out there, we're mostly looking for Earth-like planets. Even in our solar system, there's obviously other chances for life. Maybe there's life on Mars. Maybe there's life, in particular, in the ice-locked oceans of some of the moons in the outer solar system, like Jupiter's Europa or Saturn's Enceladus, things like that. But the thing is, and the trouble is, with those sorts of places, we could envision life being there, but if it's locked beneath a big shell of ice, for instance, how the heck are we going to detect it across the light years? So that's another reason why looking for an Earth-like planet is very attractive, because in that case, life would be all over the surface. It would, in theory, be ejecting byproducts of its metabolism into the atmosphere, these so-called biosignatures, and we could thus detect that from very, very far away using telescopes.
So we have things like we have telescopes. We have the Kepler mission, which is because of mechanical failure has been shuttered, at least temporarily. The plans for a terrestrial planet finder or TPF are looking pretty unlikely. Is this field losing steam, Lee Billings?
No. For Virginia, it's not. It's actually full steam ahead. The question is, it just depends on what we're trying to find. We're going to be finding a lot of planets. There's no sign of that slowing down. Planets are pouring out of the sky. They'll continue to do so for the foreseeable future. And that's because we've gotten really, really good at finding them, both from the ground and in space. But there will be what we risk, and this is a key thing that I wrote the book about. We risk a disconnect in between finding and detecting, discovering all these planets, and actually knowing what they're like. So in the very near future, it's entirely possible that you could walk outside, anyone on Earth could walk outside, and they could look up at the night sky. They could look at essentially any star in the sky, as we said earlier, and point to one of those stars and say, hey, we know that there's an Earth-mass, Earth-sized planet in the so-called habitable zone over there. It could be just like Earth. And they could do this for stars all across the sky they can point to. But we aren't actually going to know what they're like, and it'll just be a mystery. And the question is, do we want to go out there and actually discover what these places really are like? And whether or not they're really like Earth, whether or not they really have life, or if we're just going to be content to have that be a mystery.
Lee Billings, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia.
Lee Billings, science journalist and author of the book 5 Billion Years of Solitude. You can find more on the book, including some of the terrific reviews, at wordofmouthradio.org. Now stay with us. We're going to explore another edge of our understanding, the deep, deep ocean. Stay with us for that story when Word of Mouth continues.